session number 24610, reel 4.
Mr. Bob Guest, reel 4. We were talking about the Assault Pioneer training course, which you did, and off tape we just said that you did all this at Cycon Camp.
That's correct. Yeah.
Was it a camp or firing?
No, it was a camp with a permanent staff and all the normal sort of infrastructure, cookhouse and that sort of thing.
And we were talking in particular about we'd moved on to the explosives.
Yeah, the explosives. Well, there were various types of explosives that we were introduced to. There was a particular explosive which was used for fracturing bridges, which was called a nesting beehive, and this was a roughly conical shaped container with a cone inverted into it in the bottom, and the top of the cone. I would say this thing would be about, 12, 14 inches in diameter and probably 10 inches high, and then the cone coming up, say, another 5 or 6 inches. And in the top, you'd got an initiatory charge, which would be like a gun cotton primer or something similar, with a hole in it for a detonator, hole in the top for a detonator, and the cone. The idea was that when this was initiated, either with a lit fuse or an electrically fired detonator, the subsequent explosion would turn the inner cone inside out and drive it down into the bridge, very similar to an anti-tank missile, where the cone collapses within the body of the missile, and it's fired out at a great rate and with a lot of energy and heat, and it would actually fracture part of the bridge. You could have 3 or 4 of these in a row, which would really sever a bridge off at its roots.
Are they called nesting?
Nesting beehives. Beehives, yeah.
What other sorts of demolition?
We also did a ring main explosion where charges were set at various intervals around a given area, and these would be connected by electrical connections to an electrical detonator and taken back to a point of where we could use the charger. This would be, I suppose you've seen it done, it would be wound up until you get to a certain degree of voltage, and then a button would be pressed and the detonators would fire and up would go the explosives. We used to test the continuity of the electrical circuit with the detonators out, and providing this was satisfactory, then the explosives would be armed by the detonator, and obviously the next time you press the button, the explosives would go up. Also, we did a camouflage explosion, which is roughly you get a 3-inch piece of tube like a drain pipe with a steel removable pointed nozzle, shall we say, in the end, and you drive this down into the ground with a what we used to call a monkey, which is like a piece of tube with two handles on it, and you would lift it up and bang the pipe down, and this would go down into the ground 5, 6, 7 feet, and then you would draw the tube back up about 18 inches, 2 feet, and drop down 5 gun cotton primers on some instantaneous detonating fuse, or his detonating cord. This would be fired, and in effect it would actually cause a void at the bottom of this tube about 2 foot in diameter. A lot of the dirt that was dislodged would actually blow up the pipe, and the other would be a compression into the ground. Then the pipe would be left there, and you would drop down about 80 pounds of plastic explosive. You'd drop, I don't know, say 30, 40 pounds of it in, and then 3 or 4 gun cotton primers on some instantaneous detonating cord, and then it would be tamped down, and the actual, like a bulb in a thermometer almost, would be filled up with this explosive. Then the tube would be withdrawn, and the resulting hole filled with dirt, earth, stones, whatever. And then the detonating cord would be taped up to initiate recharge, like a gun cotton primer with a detonator in, and you would retire to a safe distance and explode this. The idea of this was actually to destroy a road, because the resultant crater would be about as deep as the charge that you put in, and probably up to 30, 40 feet wide. It would be a deep crater. Basically what you've done, you've buried a bomb in the ground or in roadway, and then you blow the road up. An interesting thing, actually, when I was actually in charge of this this job in Hong Kong, in Tsai Kung, and I commanded four or five blokes, and we banged this hole in the ground and put the explosive in and blew the initiatory charge up and one thing another. And then we tamped the explosive down into the hole. And then the Captain Hubbard said to me, he said, "Right, Guess," he said, "you've been in charge." He said, "Now," he said, "I want you to go down to that village," he said, "and warn the people that in 10 minutes' time there's going to be a big bang up the hill." So I went down to the village, and they were all out in the paddy fields. I said, "Anybody speak English?" "Yeah, I speak. I said, "Well, 10 minutes, I said, up on the hill, boom, you know. God, these people scattered. They got pigs out of the houses, and Christ knows what, they were going to evacuate the village." And anyway, I calmed them down, and they realised that it wasn't going to be that much of a problem. And, I told them it'd be okay. And anyway, eventually this big bang came, and there was a piece of, I don't know, I think it's a piece of rock about the size of the side of a piano came down this hillside. And I should think it stopped, I don't know, 200 yards from the from this village. But, just something that stuck in my memory.
Did you have to, any other charges you learnt, or those bird nest ring made?
No, we did. We used to make up Bangalore torpedoes.
Tell me about them.
Bangalore torpedoes, we used to use, because we did barbed wire emplacements, and we used to use a picket, which was roughly in section. It was U-shaped with, if you can imagine, a U with two arms sticking out each side. This obviously, the U-shape was to get the strength in this piece of pressed metal, which was a picket. And we used to lay plastic explosives up these pickets and press two together and put a detonating cord in and a gun cotton primer or something similar to this. And we would explode these, and these were put into a barbed wire a barbed wire fence, and that would rip a hole about, I don't know, 8 to 12 feet wide. In it would literally rip this barbed wire back, so that it would, make a path for the infantry to pass through.
Any other charges? Types of explosive charges you used, or was that about it?
That was about it. And also we used to do simple things like trip flares and that sort of thing, how to arm them.
Trip flares, yeah. Just explain them for
us. Well, trip flares are just a little plastic cylindrical box, really, on a spike. And it's got a two-way spring on it. And I should think it weighs about a pound and a half, something like that, perhaps a little less. And you laid these in a pattern in front of the infantry, in a more or less a straight line or a zigzag line or something like this, according to the contours of the ground that you're actually defending. And you'd stretch the trip wires between each flare. Now, whether these trip wires were pulled or cut, the flare would go up, and obviously it would illuminate the killing ground in front of you. And
any other tricks? And booby traps, you
mentioned. Well, yeah.
Or was that?
That was really to illuminate. And also, we were taught the art of booby trapping. You know, like.
Tell us about that.
Well, fairly simple, really. I mean, you can put a couple of pounds of explosive in a bottle. And you put a candle in the bottle with a bit of fuse up it, and you bore out the candle. Light the candle until, you know, in a safe distance so that the wax comes on the outside of the bottle. And that covers the fact that the bottle's got something in it. And somebody might, one of the enemy might come in and light this candle to show him the way, and we'll show him the way to go, sort of thing, you know. And then simple things like, what shall I say, charges behind pictures hanging on walls, a slip charge on a wire and a grenade on a door or something like this. What else was a? Oh yeah, you could have a trip wire with a self acting detonator on. Whether you cut the wire or whether you tripped it, this would be in a charge, either a mine or
a bit like the trip flares.
Yeah, very similar. Only the you know, they'd be a bit more businesslike. They would be more damaging, but obviously the trip flares were to illuminate the position in front of your position.
Anything else you were taught at?
Yes, we were taught watermanship. This was
on the assault course.
Yeah, assault pioneer course. Yeah, we were taught how to use collapsible boats. This is for ferrying infantry across a river. These were canvas boats, and they used to hold about. They'd be about eight crew, and probably hold another 12, 16 men, and you would paddle these across the river. These were entirely collapsible, made of canvas, which was waterproofed, you know, with either a rubberized or something similar paint-like substance to keep the canvas waterproof. And then also we had.
So you actually practiced with them on the river?
Oh yes, no, we practiced them on the sea actually, because this, you know, and various little bits and pieces like rubber dinghies and one thing and another. We had a what we called a whaler, which held about 16 men. This really was to teach you coordination for paddling and rowing and this sort of thing, you know. I mean, we actually taught watermanship to infantrymen when we got to Korea, but we were using American type press ply boats there. But similar sort of.
Any other things?
No, I don't think so.
What about defensive works? I mean, I know you were an assault. It was an assault. Yeah, course, yeah. But did you actually learn how to sort of set up the barbed wire?
Yes. We were taught how to set up a barbed wire fence.
How was you doing it? Was it Dannett?
No. What we were taught. I mean, we did use Dannett wire. I mean, razor wire is something new, but that's similar to razor wire, Dannett wire. We were mostly using fences, you know, ordinary barbed wire fences, yeah, where you would have a central line of pickets and barbed wire, and then you would have diagonals from each picket onto smaller pickets, and then you would thread between them. So you've got a barbed wire emplacement of up to 10, 12 foot wide, because it would be in effect like a barbed wire tent, you know. And also Dannett wire could be spread between the valleys of these emplacements.
Well, can you just explain what Dannett wire was? Because it's not a familiar term.
Dannett wire is similar to razor wire nowadays, but it's like a coil of stiff wire, which would pull out into a spiral. Yeah, and these spirals of wire would be little barbs which would be twisted onto the wire like a spring, and then you would get, I mean, this would be literally like a hedgehog all over it. I mean, it would be cutting points of wire attached to this spiral, and this would be stretched out in a line, you know, in between fences, round positions, whatever.
What about digging trenches and slip trenches? Did they learn that there, or was that?
A lot of us were building trade orientated, so we knew how to dig a trench. But yes, we were instructed how to, say, like a 25 pound gun emplacement. We would be taught how to hollow out a rough U shape, and we were taught sandbagging, and that came into action with either gun emplacements or defensive positions or anything like that. So, yeah, we were taught how to bond up fill and bond sandbags together as gun emplacements or defensive positions.
And anything else on that course? We've done a fair bit there, but...
No, I don't think so. At the end of the course, we had a test to assess our abilities, and fortunately I came out top of the class, and in so doing got recommended for my first stripe.
Did you get it?
I got it, yeah.
And so you promoted to Lance Corporal. And what about, so you then went back to the Middlesex Regiment?
Yeah, I went back to the Middlesex Regiment, but instead of doing normal, shall we say, everyday squaddies work, I went into S Company, Support Company, actually into Middlesex Assault Pioneer Platoon, and we went up into the hills in Hong Kong, not too far from Sandwai Camp, up into Bird's Hill, and we were actively building defence positions in case of attack from China over the border.
Now, what do you remember about the positions you built? What was the layout and how were they set up?
Well, the layout, there were, bunkers in the sides of the hills, but these were reinforced with sandbags, and they were, you know, pretty tidy construction. And we actually concreted roofs over the top of these bunkers, where, you know, you've got whole firing positions and steps and one thing and another, and we actually concreted the roofs over, and then we sandbagged and earth filled over the top to give protection, and we did this for a number of weeks until eventually we went to Korea.
Anything else happened while you were with the Assault Pioneer Platoon with the Middlesex? So were you just out there digging these positions? Or
well, yeah, we mostly digging positions, and I'd got a gang of three or four Chinese coolies.
How did you get on with the Chinese workers?
All right. We had a couple of carpenters there, and they were very good indeed, and they very proud of their tools. They used to have a bow source to cut the timber. You know, with the string, we wind the string up with a peg, and the saws used to be razor sharp, and they were good with them, no doubt about that.
Would they do the digging for you as well, or just the carpentry? I mean,
some digging. Yeah, we had a labouring gang which would do the digging and concreting. Of course, we didn't have any mixers; it was all shovel work, you know. And the concrete was carried up the side of the hill in a basket and tipped in the hole and levelled out, you know, and kicked around.
Were you living out there?
Yeah, we were living out there in bell tents, yeah.
What was it like living in a tent, sir?
All right, it was okay, because, I mean, we were in the open air. We weren't subject to the rigours and the discipline of the main camp, shall I say, and life was pretty good, really. And we used to get good rations up there as well, you know.
In what way? What food?
All sorts of food, really. I mean, we had tin fruit, bread and jam, butter, normal sort of vegetables, potatoes, and meat. A lot of it was tin meat.
But it was better than you got in the camp.
I think so. Yeah, because there were less of us. I mean, we weren't in a central cookhouse. We were fending for ourselves, so we had a bit of laxity as regards the.
Would you get any leave into? I mean, or local leave?
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. We got leave into Kowloon. We used to go down.
That was the nearest big town or small town.
Well, yeah, well, Kowloon, yeah, and then across the harbour was Victoria, which is the capital of Hong Kong Island.
Did you get to that as well?
Yes, we went there, yeah. We used to go, if we got a decent pass, like 48-hour pass, we'd go down to the Union Jack Club or the Soldiers and Sailors Home, and we'd get a bed and tea and toast in the morning for about, I don't know, 1 and 9 pence a night or something like this, you know. And, yeah.
And what would you do? Was it a lot of drinking or what?
No, because there wasn't. We did get a local overseas allowance, which allowed you to live a little bit better. I don't know what the idea of this local overseas allowance was. But it was to boost up your pay anyway. But a lot of it was a lot of our time was spent really window shopping. You know, it's quite a fascinating place to go to, really, Hong Kong. I mean, even then, although I mean now you wouldn't recognise it from the days we were there, but then it was very much old-fashioned type China with the big porticos across the doors and all this, you know. And I remember going down there once and having a photograph taken, and they were printed on a postcard for a Christmas card, you know, which I sent home.
That actually gives me a. I was going to ask. I was trying to get the date sorted out. You'd arrived in September. When had you started the course, roughly speaking?
I started the Assault Pioneer course on the 29th of October 1951, and I finished on the 12th of the 11th 1951, so that would be November.
So, right.
About 5 weeks.
You were attached to the Assault Pioneer Platoon from November through to when you went to the Norfolk. So.
That's right, yeah, through to, yeah. Well, you know, we were wearing Norfolk badges anyway. I mean, we were...
You were still only attached, but you were...
Attached, but we were, yeah, attached to the Middlesex Regiment.
What, anything else about your time with them, with the Assault Platoon?
No, I don't think so, really.
Any Christmas celebrations?
Yeah, we did have Christmas celebrations.
What do you remember of that?
Well, actually, just before Christmas, we had the inter-regimental boxing competition. And the Middlesex Regiment won it.
Did you go in for it?
No, I didn't. No, I like my face the way it is, to be quite honest. We had this competition, but and the Middlesex won it. But I think there was about a dozen or more competitors. but of these dozen competitors, fighting under the name of Middlesex Regiment, I think eight of them were actually Royal Norfolk men. The one that, well, one man that actually springs to mind was a chap named Bert Jelly. Now, he was a Middlesex man, and he was a big lad, and he became Far Eastern heavyweight champion in that year, you know. But there was a Wrist. He won his bout. Ginger Dean, he was in the Norfolk, so he won his bout. Miles, whose father ran a boxing booth, he won his bout. And a chap named Buller. They were all Norfolks, and they all were, you know, stood in very good stead. And to say it was almost a whitewash right through the competition. I mean, the other battalions didn't stand a chance. It's yeah. And then come Christmas, obviously we had a Christmas dinner, and it was a bit special. I think we had turkey, and we had Christmas morning, we had gunfire served in the huts.
Gunfire,
yeah, which is tea laced with rum, served by the officers and the sergeants. And they brought you tea in bed. That was one morning a year. a couple of the sergeants got a little bit over enthusiastic, and they bought this gunfire tea, and they also bought some Chinese firecrackers in, which they lit and threw into the hut. Unfortunately, it set two blokes' mosquito nets alight, and they were in quite a panic for a while. And then in the Christmas afternoon, I mean, I don't know if it was actually Christmas Day, but it was over the Christmas period. Things were fairly low-key, and there wasn't too many duties to do. We did have a concert party come up from Hong Kong, or from Kowloon. Some of these were in the Hong Kong Defence Force, and they played quite a good show of it. We had guitarists and piano playing, and we had a Chinese there doing a mock sword fight with his pal. A group of NCOs from the, I think it's from the Royal Artillery somewhere, they had formed a choir, and they did a some songs from South Pacific. I think that's about all, really. Anyway, yeah, a good time was had by all.
And how long were you with them after that?
Not very long, actually, because I got made Lance Corporal, and previously, and I found myself as Corporal of the Guard on January the 6th. I wasn't very happy, because I think, if I remember rightly, Christmas night I was Corporal of the Guard.
Now, what were your duties as Corporal of the Guard?
Basically to make sure the sentries were alert, and change sentries when necessary, and take orders from the sergeant in charge. And it's fairly simple, actually. And then I think it was Christmas night I did this. And then I got picked on January the 6th, which was my birthday. I wasn't very happy about that. I spent my 21st birthday as Corporal of the Guard in Hong Kong, and subsequently spent my 22nd birthday in a prisoner of war camp in Korea, but more of that later.